is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday. So let's dive right into our Week in Review. More fallout from the Jeffrey Epstein scandal. Labor Secretary Alex Acosta is out.
I submitted my resignation to the president, effective 7 days from today.
And until this came up, there was never an ounce of problem with this very good man.
We will also tackle the use of facial recognition software by law enforcement.
This technology poses an unprecedented threat to our privacy and civil liberties.
There is no blanket sharing of data with any federal agency associated with law enforcement.
And tensions are growing between two prominent House Democrats.
Overwhelmingly, our caucus voted to protect the children. Our blue dogs, our moderates, and all the rest voted to protect the children. They did not.
Well, it's not true. I mean, it's just wrong.
Is that a personal beef or a sign of a growing rift in the party? With us to break it all down is our Week in Review panel. Renee Graham is an associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Hey, Renee, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
And Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Ed, welcome back to you.
Great to be back.
Hey, listeners, we've expanded our Week in Review segment because we want to hear from you. What are you thinking about the biggest stories of the week? Weigh in. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to dive right in. We're going to start with the big news of the day. U.S. Labor Secretary Alex Acosta has resigned in the wake of the Jeffrey Epstein arrest. The arrest happened on Saturday. Acosta was a federal prosecutor in Florida who agreed to Epstein's original plea deal in 2007, which has become quite controversial. Now, as of Wednesday, Acosta seemed to feel he had the president's support and would be staying on, although he did qualify that a little bit.
I serve at the pleasure of the president.
Well, this just in, the president became displeased. So, Renee, why is he out now?
You know, if you watch that press conference that Acosta had, all I kept thinking of was Brett Kavanaugh. And if you thought about that, Brett Kavanaugh was on Fox News before he gave his testimony in his confirmation hearing. He was very demure. He was very quiet. That doesn't play well for Donald Trump. Donald Trump wants a performance. And Acosta was very professorial. He was very studious. He was sort of giving this very detailed explanation, but it wasn't the kind of fire and emotion that the president generally likes. And I thought he did himself a disservice in terms of appealing to Donald Trump.
So, Ed, that implies that the president likes to put somebody out there and sort of have them audition to keep their job by giving a fiery performance. It does seem that there's a pattern there. Is that what happened here? And did Trump do the right thing by saying, no, you're out?
The president seems to see America as an audience and not a nation. He seems to watch all of American politics through a television screen. Everything is a performance to him. I agree with what Renee said, that he simply failed. I don't really think this is a question of ethics, though I would like to think it was. I think also you have to consider that Donald Trump is also in the universe of people around Epstein. And I think that it's not impossible that he could somehow be dragged into this in some way. And perhaps it was nicer to have a fall guy around for if this gets worse.
So I do want to come back a little bit later to the Donald Trump Acosta Epstein connections, but I want to get into the details of this for a minute first for the listeners. For years, Acosta has said that as the federal prosecutor in this case, he took the deal in 2007 because he wanted to make sure that Epstein served time.
The Palm Beach State Attorney's Office was ready to let Epstein walk free, no jail time, nothing. Prosecutors in my former office found this to be completely unacceptable. And they became involved. Our office became involved. Our prosecutors presented the ultimatum: plead guilty to more serious charges, charges that required jail time, registration, and restitution, or we'd roll the dice and bring a federal indictment.
Renee, what do you make of that defense?
Well, you know, I thought it was interesting because within hours, some of the other attorneys who worked on this said that's not the case. Acosta really tried to paint himself as the hero in this, sort of doing the best he could do, you know, to put Epstein behind bars. But, you know, you're talking about the charges that Jeffrey Epstein was facing, the fact that he did 13 months of what was essentially kind of a work release. you know, there's no way, it's an indefensible sentence. So, you know, Acosta was trying to put the best face on it, but the facts don't bear it out.
Okay, so two things. First, listeners, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Call in and join the conversation. Also, I do want to make it clear, I was being a little snarky at the top, but we don't actually know if Acosta chose to resign or if President Trump asked him to or forced him to. Now, Ed, Renee has tiptoed into this question of the plea deal itself. Earlier this week, we asked retired federal judge and WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner about the plea deal. Here's what she said.
It was a stunning deal. It's a stunning deal. It was a stunning deal when it was disclosed. It really is a stunning deal. And it's a deal of no prosecution. It's not a plea bargain on the federal side. It was a deal not to prosecute after they had actually drawn up pages and pages and pages of charges. So it was an extraordinary deal.
And, of course, as the federal prosecutor, Acosta could have filed charges regardless of a deal struck by the state. So, Ed, how do you think Epstein got away with so little punishment here?
It sounds like he was just a wealthy and powerful man, and we don't have equal justice in this country on cases like this. And also it sounds like that he had friends and lawyers simply wear out the desire of the prosecutors to hold him accountable, that this isn't just about who you know. It's do you have the resources to grind the system in a way that it's going to decide it's not worth trying to get justice from you. And people like him can do that.
Ed, what do you mean by wear out the desire?
Well, I mean, we have reports the fact that the lawyers for Epstein were incredibly, you know, voluminous, what they produced, how often they went after him, making everything take longer. They can add extraordinary costs to a prosecution, and therefore that reduces the incentives of the prosecutors to keep going and going and going when someone without those resources would have a much quicker process. So justice denied takes many forms. One of them is people with resources can wear out the system.
Renee.
You know, when we talk about criminal justice reform, it's often in the idea of eradicating mass incarceration. This is the opposite side of that coin. This is someone who essentially got away with almost everything, you know, because of his privilege, because of his power, because of knowing all the right people in all the right places. You know, it came out yesterday that, you know, one of the things that Epstein had to agree to was to be a registered sex offender. Well, registered sex offenders have to check in with their local police department. In 8 years, he never did it once.
So there's an impunity that runs past just the deal itself.
Exactly.
Here. We do want to hear from you listeners at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So both of you have made reference to the powerful friends that Epstein had. He's known for that kind of network of connections. Let's listen to what President Trump said today about his own relationship with Epstein. I think we're having some technical difficulties, so let me just move on from there. He said that Epstein was not somebody that he respected. He threw him out. He said James Patterson, who's a famous member of Mar-a-Lago, made a statement yesterday pointing out that he'd thrown him out. But we also know that he said some other things in the past that aren't consistent with that. In 2002, he said to New York Magazine, quote, "I've known Jeff for 15 years. Terrific guy. He's a lot of fun to be with. It is even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side." Then the New York Times has reported some troubling things, including a 1992 party where the entire guest list consisted of 28 girls attending a, quote, calendar girl, unquote, competition with Trump and Epstein. And there was a 2016 lawsuit filed by a woman under the name Jane Doe that claimed in 1994, when she was 13, that she was raped by President Trump at Epstein's house. He wasn't president at the time of the rape. That lawsuit was dropped on November 4th, 2016. Ed, how dangerous is this emerging story for the president of the United States?
It's not dangerous at all. I hate saying that, but I mean, this, how could President Trump's reputation in this area be any worse than it already is? We're already at bottom. It's a question of what do we do about this? It's like guns. How many people have to get shot before we do something about the way guns are managed in this country? I don't know what's going to happen to President Trump. I can't even guess.
So Arlene from Salem is awesome and held on with us. So we're going to go back to her and try again. Hey, Arlene.
Hey.
Hey
there.
Good
afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Yep.
I mean, we have the similar case, very similar to Epstein, is R. Kelly as well. You know, and why didn't he get one of those sweetheart deals like Mr. Epstein did? And I'm not certainly justifying what Mr. R. Kelly has done, but you know, it just goes to show the differences, the double standards. It is just a very sad circumstances that our country is watching. It's terrible. We're living this. It is absolutely horrific.
Thank you for that, Arlene. Renee, what do you think?
I don't really know that I would hold R. Kelly up as the best example of you know, a difference between Jeffrey Epstein. You know, R. Kelly has been accused of sexual misconduct for a quarter century. Yes, he had a trial. Yes, he was acquitted. And for a long time, his career just went along just fine. The biggest stars worked with him. He sold millions of records and sold out arenas. So, you know, the question becomes, do the rules apply to powerful men? And that's what Jeffrey Epstein and R. Kelly have in common. Both very powerful men. You know, yes, the chickens may be coming home to roost now, but they've gotten away with an awful lot for a very long time.
Listeners, do please keep calling in 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Charlie from Bedford is on the line. Charlie, what's on your mind?
I think that it ought to be worth mentioning that this wasn't just a non-prosecution agreement to not prosecute Epstein. It was a non-prosecution agreement to not prosecute anybody else who may have been involved in a conspiracy or confederation involving the rape and assault of these children. Including potentially Alan Dershowitz.
Yeah, so perfect, Charlie. Let's pick up from there because this is something that I've been thinking about. What about the rest of Epstein's powerful friends? As Charlie from Bedford says, some of them kind of got blanket coverage in this immunity deal, but he's been connected to people like Bill Clinton, Alan Dershowitz, Kevin Spacey. Ed, you said the president, unfortunately, in your words, is not vulnerable here, but how about some of these other powerful men?
Perhaps. I do think that what Charlie brought up was important, that it was clearly a desire to make this whole issue go away at the time and have no one else be held accountable for this. I have a hard time imagining that these people will come back into the spotlight without something else happening. I'm not optimistic about that. What I really hope is that there's a change in the culture in the justice system from end to end, from the people who do the, you know, the prison arrangements, the people who do the indicting, that we see more justice. We can't be a society that says that our own DA shouldn't be letting people off, not go to jail for minor things while rich and powerful people get sweet deals. I think we have to reconcile those and say things and say we need justice from end to end in the system, and I hope we see the change.
So staying on the subject of rich and powerful men, but shifting gears to a more local story. Earlier this week, there was some interesting developments in the case with Kevin Spacey down on the Cape, because the young person who accused him of sexual assault pleaded the fifth in his own criminal prosecution of Spacey. And that probably means that the case is likely going to be dismissed. That's what legal scholars seem to think. One of the questions that's come out of the Me Too movement is whether any of the increased attention to these types of stories lead to real, actual consequences for the powerful, kind of to your point earlier, Renee. So do you think the Me Too movement has actually helped people who are accused of assault or harassment hold their the people who have assaulted them accountable?
I think what the Me Too movement has done is empowered victims and survivors to tell their stories, you know, to feel like they don't have to live in silence. They can come forward and talk about what happened to them. What the movement itself can't do is completely dismantle these entrenched systems and institutions that protect men, especially powerful men. You know, that's not on Me Too. That's on all of us. You know, that's not on survivors to do. That's on everyone else to do. So when you have a system where someone like Jeffrey Epstein or Kevin Spacey or R. Kelly, you know, what happened in the Kevin Spacey case was, you know, the victim was put on trial. And that's been seen time and time again whenever you have a case of sexual misconduct. So, you know, that's not new. You have to break that down. That's part of what the Me Too movement is trying to do. But to do that's going to take a lot more effort from everyone.
So we're going to shift gears now to a different story, but one that is, I think, about people being concerned that some new system not become entrenched before there are things that we can do about it. And that's this question of facial recognition software, its use with the RMV and with other law enforcement agencies. Listeners, we want you to call in on this subject. How do you feel about facial recognition, the RMV, law enforcement using it? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So it turns out if you have a driver's license, you're part of this massive database that federal law enforcement regularly scans looking for potential matches. We talked about it on Radio Boston earlier this week after a Washington Post report revealed that the FBI and ICE routinely search these databases across the country. So, Ed, first of all, what do you make of the revelation and, you know, that driver's licenses are being scanned, the pictures are in the databases by law enforcement? Are you okay with it?
Not really, but I believe this for many years. I've been a computer scientist most of my life. I know people that do machine learning, AI, and image classification, and the public has no idea what's possible now, and they haven't thought through the consequences of software being this intelligent and applied broadly. We have to really think about where are the firewalls in the system, how we want this to be used, and I think everyone should take a deep breath and think seriously about this.
So Governor Baker has weighed in on the issue, and let's hear what he had to say.
The only time the RMV responds to any sort of a request is a very particular and specific one that involves a federal inquiry. Usually it involves criminal activity. There is no blanket sharing of data with any federal agency associated with law enforcement.
Reassured, Renee?
You know, with all due respect to the governor, it always starts with there's no blanket acceptance of this. And then we find out later on, yeah, it was kind of blankety, but not as blankety as people think. I mean, you know, the bottom line is that we still live in this sort of world where we think that our privacy is our own. We think our faces are our own. We surrender all kinds of information through social media, but there's something really disturbing when you realize that the government is also doing this. One of the bigger issues I have with facial recognition is, and this came out of the MIT Media Lab a year or so ago, is that it's inaccuracy. You know, if you're a white male, the error rate is about 1%. If you are a black or a brown female, the error rate is about 35%.
Yeah, we've got clip on this. So Cade Crawford of the ACLU of Massachusetts talked about this report when she was on earlier this week. Let's listen.
There have been studies, including studies here in Cambridge at MIT, that have found that the algorithms that animate these technologies actually have racial bias embedded in them. So, for example, some of these algorithms sold by even prominent technology companies have error rates up to 35% when they're examining the faces of black women. Whereas with white men, the technology works about 99% of the time.
Okay, so Ed, first, what do you think about a company selling something with a 35% error rate when it comes to black women? And second, how do you feel about law enforcement using a technology with this much bias in it?
The system is full of biases. Software sometimes imports the biases we already have. I think a lot of this was accidental. I actually know how these algorithms work, the training data was bad. They probably trained. Most of this kind of machine learning is done by feeding computers millions and millions of something and having them sort of learn things. If your database is full of all white men, then you're going to get good at that and not good at anything else. So there's lots of reasons why bias creeps into AI. But I think it's more important that the public recognizes that we need to regulate how this software is used and be wise about it, being that software is now embedded in everything. We probably can't stop it even if we wanted to.
So let's take another call. We've got Nico on the line from Manchester. Nico, share your thoughts with us.
Hey, I want to say that I don't think that AI facial recognition technology should be used by the FBI and by police, at least right now, because I think that it's going to be an encroachment on civil liberties and an invasion of the Fourth Amendment, which protects citizens from unreasonable search and seizure. And AI technology just overrides that and doesn't really give a judge the ability of, like, hey, if you want to look into somebody, you have to get a warrant to do that. And AI technology and facial recognition just overrides that Fourth Amendment entirely.
Great.
The civil liberties.
Great. Nico, thanks. And actually, what I want to do is I want to pair your voice, Nico, with another voice that we have, which was Scott Hovsepian. He's the president of the Massachusetts Coalition of Police. He was speaking to Channel 5 about facial recognition software.
If one catastrophe could be saved, if one abducted child can be found quicker, one murder victim's suspect is identified quicker, and the person can be brought to justice, I don't see why that's a bad thing.
So we've got this tension, Renee, between civil liberties and, hey, we can protect people, keep them safe, and prosecute. How do we think about that tension?
I mean, there's always that tension between safety and privacy. You know, if you remember right after 9/11, you had that color-coded terrorism chart. You know, we want yellow or it was red. You know, fear is great to control people. You know, we need to do this to keep you safe. And in the meantime, your rights are being eroded. You know, and suddenly it's like, well, no, this is good for you. Well, maybe it's not good for us. And maybe we have a right to opt out of these things. You know, when people go to the RMV to get their license, no one is telling them how that's going to be used and in some cases used against them.
So I want to put together two more voices that we have on tape here. The first, Senator Cynthia Cream has introduced a bill that would put a short-term moratorium on the use of facial recognition software. Here's one of the arguments for why she wants to do that.
I have constituents who have said to me, I'm going to march in a march. I march in the Women's March. I don't even know if there's going to be drones taking pictures of me. And then that is going to be used in a way by a government agency.
So that's a moratorium until we can put legislation in place that would regulate appropriately. So let's hear Cade Crockford again of the Massachusetts ACLU talking about what we need in terms of regulatory standards.
Walking into the 21st century with clear eyes, understanding across the board what we're doing with these technologies, which government agencies should be authorized to use these systems, under what circumstances, subject to which types of legislative and judicial authorization on a case-by-case basis. And that's just not happening right now.
So, Ed, that's a big lift. Should law enforcement have to wait with this kind of moratorium that Senator Cream is proposing until we get to the standard that Cade Crockford was just talking about?
I think it's going to be hard to come up with these standards. But, yes, I agree that law enforcement should be constrained, and in more than one way. They should be constrained in how they can access this. They should be constrained in what tools they get to use. But it's more important that we kind of put firewalls in place. This isn't just about law enforcement. This technology is already being deployed widely. We're always on camera everywhere we go. When all these databases start getting united, it's going to compromise our ability to feel like we're free, independent people moving around the world. If I know that I'm being filmed everywhere and that there are these incredibly powerful programs that will suck in all this data from all these places and show everything I'm doing all the time, will begin to make me feel like I'm not a free citizen. And that's possible. And law enforcement is just the beginning of what we need to do to consider the consequences of all this.
Okay, so Renee, that's haunting. But before we take a quick break, let me just ask you, aren't we kind of already there?
You know, as a thought exercise, not that long ago, I sort of counted the number of cameras from my office to my front door, and it was about a dozen cameras. Yes, Ed's right. You know, we're on cameras all the time, whether we know it or not. But I do think there's a difference between a security camera and the idea that the government is allowing the FBI to have access to this kind of information without our say-so.
So we're going to turn now to our third topic, which is the growing tension between congressional Democrats this week, specifically between House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Listeners, if you want to jump in on this, please call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So this started with what was called, quote, the squad, end quote. They've been called that for a while now, for progressive freshman Democrats, including Representative Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They voted against a House border aid bill. They were the only four Democrats to vote against the bill. Speaker Pelosi called the four out, not joining the rest of the party.
Overwhelmingly, our caucus voted to protect the children. Our blue dogs, our moderates, and all the rest voted to protect the children. They did not.
Okay, so Renee, first off, what do you make of the squad voting against the bill?
You know, I think they're voting their values. I think the bill was not what they wanted it to be, and I think that's what they voted for what felt right to them. You know, I do think it was inappropriate for Pelosi to call them out. She could have that conversation with them privately. But I don't have a problem with them voting against a bill they didn't believe in.
How about you, Ed? What did you think?
I think this is wonderful. I don't mean that in the partisan way. The House of Representatives is meant to represent the passions of the people and is meant to be a place of squabbling. And this squabbling sounds very productive. This isn't like squabbling under Speaker Ryan or Speaker Boehner, where, you know, Republicans are debating should America pay its bills and all of that. I think that, this kind of squabbling is about what the Democratic Party stands for and what should happen in the House of Representatives, what's worth voting on. I think this is what was intended, and I'm enjoying watching it.
So Representative Ocasio-Cortez pushed back, kind of suggesting that maybe there was something a little bit dangerous or inappropriate about this. Let's listen to her talking to CNN yesterday.
It's singling out four individuals. And knowing the media environment that we're operating in, knowing the amount of death threats that we get, knowing the amount of concentration of attention, I think it's just worth asking why.
And Renee, she had said as part of that larger interview that she felt that this was the speaker calling out four young women of color who were newly elected. Do you think race is a factor here specifically?
I don't at the moment. You know, I do think that Speaker Pelosi's tone was condescending. I do feel like it felt like she was scolding them in a way that is inappropriate. They are grown women. They are not children. But I, at this point, will say I don't think race had anything to do with what she felt. She's trying to keep the House Democrats in order the way she sees fit. But I do feel like there's another way for her to go about this.
All right. So the lines are full. Callers want to talk to us. We're going to go to Adrian from Arlington. Adrian, what's on your mind?
Hi, guys. You know, just to preface, I'm 25 years old. I'm pretty young, so I identify a lot with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And I kind of like that the squad is doing what they think is right and not just falling in line. I think that too often it's just expected that everybody's going to fall in line. And I think that, you know, they're representatives. They represent the people. And as a Bostonian, Ayanna Pressley is my representative, and I'm glad that she, you know, took a stand, so...
Thanks for that, Adrian. Ed, it's a little bit like what you were saying. Hey, this is healthy. We're mixing it up. We're having some conflict. This is productive to debate. Is that right?
Sure. And, you know, I don't think people should have to fall in line. We've had many years of watching Republicans not fall in line. I don't see why the Democrats should have to fall in line either. I think that people, again, the founders intended the fact that the House of Representatives, people would represent their individual districts. They didn't say, well, we're going to have a system where Republicans and Democrats are going to have two teams and they'll fall in line and fight each other over the aisle. They envisioned none of that. I think that if Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez thinks her constituents want this, then she should just do it and not worry about how she looks.
Okay, so Renee, to this fall in line question, as I've been watching this unfold, what I keep thinking about is Speaker John Boehner, the Republican speaker, and his dealings with the Tea Party as they emerged in his caucus. He initially dismissed them, but he was eventually replaced as speaker because, in part, his conflicts with them and because he couldn't get anything done. So is Pelosi at risk here?
You know, she might be. But, you know, it's worth remembering that when the Democrats took the House back last year, there was this push to get Pelosi out. These women stood behind her and they stood with her. So
all four of them did.
All four of them did. You know, even though there was some question of whether or not they would and how what they were saying during the campaign, they stood with Pelosi. I don't know that they're ready to break with Pelosi now. I do think there is a kind of frustration that's bubbling over because, I mean, they also, you know, they very much want an impeachment inquiry and Pelosi isn't there yet. So I think that's part of what's bubbling over in some of this. But, you know, we're in this uncommon time. And I think these women are fired up with a kind of why we can't wait sentiment, to quote Martin Luther King's line. You know, I don't want to tell Speaker Pelosi to be mindful of her tone, but I don't know that any generation has cornered the market on caring about, you know, the future of this nation.
All right, let's take another call. We've got Steve from Dorchester. Steve, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Well, I believe in what these four women are, at least the one that we're talking, AOC, has to say. But we have to remember that they're all new. They have to be careful themselves. Pelosi might have been condescending in their eyes. She might have just been saying, listen, this is how it works. We all get a voice. But you're last in line. Let's not forget what AOC did for a living 9 months ago. She's not an expert on anything yet. And I think we ought to treat it that way.
So thanks for that, Steve. So, Ed, what does experience look like in the squad as they move along? And also, I guess I wonder, isn't part of their edge and their power the fact that they are new and younger and less experienced in Congress?
No, their power is because they are popular. They've got media attention. There are other people who are new in Congress who are getting no attention at all. Even people of color in Congress who are not getting much attention at all. They have the spotlight. which makes them seem more important than they are. There are many other representatives who are righteous, who represent their constituents. Their opinions are no less important in terms of how the House operates. But because these four women have captured national attention, that they have their finger on the pulse of the changes in the party, that they are getting more attention, perhaps they deserve it. But it does not mean that Speaker Pelosi should manage things differently, because she must take in consideration all the other districts in the country.
Okay, let's take one more call. Michael from Providence, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to say that Nancy Pelosi is very smart and chooses her words very carefully. She knows what she's doing. She's an expert politician. And to posture herself sort of in opposition to the squad, these four representatives, it's a safe spar to show that she's not just catering towards the progressive left and she's staying towards the center, which is really important if we're going to maintain our majority in the House.
Thanks for that. Renee, how does the Democratic Party manage messaging to the middle of America as well as its emerging progressive, some people would argue, coasts, which may or may not be the right framing, but we hear it a lot.
Well, you know, I think it's worth remembering what happened last November in the elections. You know, people really did vote for change. There's a reason why the squad won. You know, and that's not necessarily what the establishment Democrats were expecting. Certainly they weren't expecting someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to beat, you know, a 20-year incumbent. Or Ayanna Pressley, the same thing with beating Mike Capuano. I think the party is going through some growing pains. It's trying to figure out what it needs to be. But at the end of the day, the agenda is the same. However they get there, it's to right this country and defeat Donald Trump. I don't think there's any question about that. And I think so long as the party stays focused on that, the infighting will sort itself out.
All right. So there has been a lot there. Thanks to everyone who chimed in. Before we let you two go, I do want to end with our hubbubs. Those are those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Renee, let's have you go first. What do you got?
Saturday is the 6th annual JP Porch Fest.
Oh, I love Porch Fest.
Porch Fest is the best. And for those who don't know, it's 150 acts, live music, live performances, everything from hip hop to folk to classical to rock. It is wonderful. And it's exactly what it says. People performing on porches, in driveways, you name it. What can be better on a summer day in Boston than live free music?
Almost nothing, as a matter of fact. Okay, Ed, what do you got for us?
Well, I noticed something this week didn't get much attention, which is that supposedly the pharmaceutical industry, a big industry in Massachusetts, is unhappy with the governor because he is proposing limits on what Medicaid or MassHealth here will pay for drugs. It's kind of a unique thing in the country to see a governor pushing to lower drug costs. But for me, it was significant, even though it didn't get much coverage, because it was kind of a Nixon goes to China moment. This is a man who's a healthcare insurance executive who knows everything about these industries. They have gone to his fundraisers, he's spoken at their conferences, and now he's trying to do the right thing in a way that the people go to his Lee fundraisers are not liking. And I wonder whether or not that this is a sign of things to come with terms of compromise between business and politics, and what will our governor do with all of his popularity? And I think the drug thing is really interesting to see how far that goes and whether that will affect other issues, climate, taxes, and things. So I think it was really, really rare and interesting, and I didn't think got enough attention this week.
All right, so after you go to Porch Fest and enjoy the music, you can think long and hard about the political and business implications of Ed's hubbub. For me, it was the groundbreaking on the new AAA ball field in Worcester this week, where the Paw Sox are eventually going to move and be the Woo Sox or something else. And I thought it was just interesting in that it's an exciting event and a wonderful turn of events for Worcester and a loss for Pawtucket, Rhode Island. And it just sets in relief how a move like this benefits one community, but another community loses both business, but also sort of tradition and a piece of their identity. And I think it's possible to be excited for Worcester and sad for Pawtucket and recognize the good and the bad in that. All right. Well, Renee Graham, associate editor and columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor, thanks so much for
Great
being
to be
with
here.
Us.
Thank you.
Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer, thanks for your time and insight today.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, thanks for participating with us in our first expanded Week in Review. Stay with us. Coming up, where does your local library rank statewide? Our next guests are on a quest to find the answer, no matter where you live in Massachusetts.